Yes, thank you. Thank you, Paul. I've had a back thing recently, so I'm standing in the hope that I shall continue to stand. I think I'm over this thing. So part of Thomas Merton's influence as a spiritual writer, and he's considered by many to have been the most important spiritual writer in America in the last 100 years, was his recommending of religious contemplation for all human beings, not only for those in monastic orders. Nevertheless, for Merton, the achieving of the deepest level of contemplation required, he believed, a sacrifice of the active life, in his case, the life of writer and artist, a sacrifice that might be deemed a failure if one considers that before his accidental death in 1968, he had authored more than 50 books. Moreover, from within his monastery, Merton felt connected to those who were out in the world pursuing social justice. In order to balance the demands of contemplation and action, Merton divided contemplation into different levels, recognizing that some of these were more compatible with action than others. Although Merton burned some of his unpublished writings prior to going into the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky, the Trappist monastery that he entered in 1941, it wasn't long before he found himself writing and publishing poetry and penning a best-selling autobiography. Moreover, he was assigned writing tasks by his abbot. Nonetheless, from at least as early as 1949, Merton found himself longing for greater solitude, where he could include in his life, as he put it in his journal, some real and solid contemplation. In 1953, he received permission from his abbot to occupy a tool shed on the monastery grounds during the afternoons. In 1960, a hermitage was erected for him, a hermitage that was only fully completed so that Merton could live in it full time in 1965. In the meantime, he lived a busy life, first as a master of scholastics and as a master of novices throughout the 50s and into 1965. Ironically, by 1968, Merton found that too many visitors were flocking to his Kentucky hermitage, and he set off in search of another location, visiting possible sites in New Mexico, Northern California, and Alaska. Before he could make up his mind, he died on a trip to Asia, a trip that included visiting Hindu ashrams in northern India, Buddhist temples in Sri Lanka, before addressing an international meeting of monks in Thailand. What Merton slowly came to weigh regretfully was that the Trappists, even with their rule of silence in the 1940s, were essentially a communal order with little room for solitaries. For this reason, his asking for greater solitude was only very gradually accepted by his abbot, and Merton found himself looking around through correspondence with a number of people for a more solitary place than he had in Kentucky. In 1956, James Fox, his abbot in the 50s and for most of the 60s, brought Merton into contact with a psychoanalyst and author, Dr. Gregory Zilborg, who showed little sympathy for Merton's situation, telling him that his desire for a hermitage was false and vain. "You want a hermitage in Times Square," he told Merton, with a large sign over it saying, "Hermit." The encounter threw Merton into a paroxysm of anger and self-doubt without, it goes without saying, in any way resolving the conflict between his Trappist vocation and his desire for solitude. Merton linked his own search for solitude with that of his contemporaries in mainstream society, whom he perceived as subjected to endless distraction by the institutions that surrounded them. With silence and solitude, Merton believed, the self could gradually be heard above the collective clamor, and at that point one could discover within a spiritually fertile emptiness that Merton paradoxically referred to as the unborn flower of nothing. Having shed external and distracting versions of itself, the newly born true self could reveal at its core what he called a paradise tree. Although Merton had been baptized according to the rite of the Church of England in southeastern France, where his parents happened to be living at the time, he was essentially raised in a secular environment. However, images of the clean stone churches and abbeys associated with his earliest years in France, he later confided, stayed in his mind. In his well-known autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, he indicated that he became more actively engaged by Christianity in general and by Roman Catholicism in particular during his years at Columbia University in the 1930s. His conversion, he later said, began with the realization of the presence of God in this present life, in the world, and in myself. His thinking in this respect was derived in part from William Blake, who had been the subject of his MA thesis at Columbia. Merton had been wary about the rationalistic tenor of Counter-Reformation Catholicism, and so in his innovative thesis on Blake, he attempted to reconcile Blake's visionary Christianity with the rationalism of Thomas Aquinas, a philosophical squaring of the circle. Although he would always affirm Aquinas' dynamic conception of God as pure act, Merton would feel himself drawn increasingly to the Christian mystical tradition of intuitive contemplation, a tradition that had been marginalized by Western Catholicism since the 16th century. Religious contemplation, as Merton thought of it, was an experiential and intuitive awareness of God as God actually exists, separated from our tendency to view God merely in terms of our own needs and anxieties, and separate as well from our philosophical and theological conceptualizing about God. Contemplative awareness meant that one could adjust the perception of oneself in relation to God along lines that conformed to reality, that in coming to know God, one came to know one's true self and one's true relationship to the rest of creation and to society. This newly perceived relationship to God, Merton described as a creative and dynamic intervention by God into our daily life. For Merton, this intervention involved the presence of God in the self, not as an object within like a jewel in a box, but rather of God as the transcendent source of our own subjectivity. In this way, our ego self disappeared and we came to know ourselves truly by letting go of a self that was false and unreal. Through contemplation, one arrived at the inmost ground of one's life. Moreover, when we find God in religious contemplation, in Merton's view, we find the reality underlying our fellow human beings, so that we see them not as an institution might see them, but rather as distinct persons, each valued by God and thus deserving of our care and of justice, a justice that for Merton encompassed even the ecological integrity of the earth as the divinely created cradle of life. Merton repeatedly emphasized the importance of mystery in relationship to contemplation. A luminous example of his attraction to mystery is the passage from his Asian Journal in 1968, in which, looking with awe at the Himalayan peak Mount Kanchenjunga in northern India, he felt frustrated by the fact that due to political restrictions, he would not be able to view the Tibetan side of the mountain. Subsequent to this disappointment, however, he had the following dream. I was looking at the mountain, and it was pure white, absolutely pure, especially the peaks that lie to the west. And I saw the pure beauty of their shape and outline all in white. And I heard a voice saying, or got the clear idea of, there is another side to the mountain. I realized that it was turned around and everything was lined up differently. I was seeing from the Tibetan side. There is another side of Kanchenjunga and of every mountain, the side that has never been photographed. That is the only side worth seeing. For Merton, mystery was not an end in itself, but a requisite state of mind to make genuine contemplation possible. This became evident in his encounter with the large figures of the Buddha in Polonnaruwara in Sri Lanka in December of 68. Looking at the figures, he felt himself jerked clean, as he put it, out of the habitual half-tied vision of things, and led to an inner clarity in which there was no mystery. Mystery lost its usefulness, as it were, when the voyaging consciousness of the contemplative reached, however temporarily, a terminus in reality. Merton noted the mystery implicit in the darkness imagery employed by mystics like John of the Cross. Within this contemplative night, he remarked, there is the possibility and the challenge to realign our deepest intentions. Lying below the layers of conceptual understanding and belief is our creaturely self, through whom in the night of contemplation we disappear into God, feeling as if we know God alone. In the dark night of the soul, one's familiar illusory self suddenly feels itself meaningless, a stage that must precede one's discovery of a new self based upon one's felt dependence on the mercy of God. Apart from the external tension between Merton's communal monasticism and his desire for greater solitude and more sustained contemplation, he felt an even deeper conflict between contemplation and action within the compass of his own life. He was a natural writer and perhaps would have become a writer academic had he not entered the monastery. While a student at Columbia, where he attracted the respect and friendship of Mark Van Doren, he wrote reviews for the New York Times and the New York Herald Tribune. Later in the monastery, he tried to come to grips with the conflict between his dual vocations as contemplative and writer by dividing contemplation into three levels, each with varying degrees of distance from the active life. He laid these out in two essays, Poetry and the Contemplative Life, 1947, and Poetry and Contemplation, A Reappraisal, 1958. The three kinds of contemplation were natural contemplation, active contemplation, and infused contemplation. Infused contemplation, Merton explained, was the most treasured form of contemplation, in which the soul was permeated by the presence of God, whose closeness, while one was in a state of infused contemplation, reached into the very center of one's being. Nevertheless, it is important to recognize that for Merton there was no essential contradiction between contemplation and action, that the two, in his view, supported each other in a balanced Christian life. He remarked, for example, that in the eyes of Saint Benedict, both action and contemplation were essential in the monastic life. Furthermore, he stated the actions of those religious people who lacked a contemplative dimension would inevitably be shallow, cut off from the deepest levels of their faith. Natural contemplation, Merton pointed out, was the sort of contemplation exercised by the artist and the philosopher, who contemplated being in its various religious and ontological manifestations. In this respect, Merton described the poet Edwin Muir in 1966 as one who, through his poetry, reached the intimate, that is, ontological sources of life. The artist's imagination was ontological in that it created alternate worlds by which one might evaluate this one, a view of art that is apparent in William Blake, who, Merton said, drew him to Christianity. Blake had imagined an alternate world, for example, in which there was a marriage of heaven and hell. In addition to the creation of alternate worlds, the polarities of time could be reconciled through the artist's contemplative imagination, as the heroes of Homer and the biblical patriarchs, Merton observed, not only mingle in the modern artist's imagination, but coexist with him. Indeed, their experience is typologically realized in the crises of the modern artist's own life. By searching out analogies that reveal hidden resemblances and unexpected meanings, the artist unites, Merton argued, that which all but the deepest philosophical and religious examples of reason and experience would perceive as fragmentary. There is in all things an invisible fecundity, Merton wrote in 1963, and a hidden wholeness. While he insisted that he was not a pantheist, Merton never tired of contemplating traces of the beauty and variety of the divine in nature. In this way, he became aware of the ultimate perfection of nature in God, not simply as the perfection of the idea of nature, as in Plato, but God as an actualized perfection, as in Aquinas. Well, the Czech writer Milos chided Merton for ignoring the Darwinian harshness of nature. The Polish writer. Merton accepted the predatory aspects of animals as consistent with their nature. An example of his point of view can be found in his journal entry for February 1951, in which he watched in awe as a hawk swooped down on a starling, killed it, and then patiently ate it. While initially uncomfortable about what he had seen, Merton concluded that the hawk was to be studied by saints and contemplatives because he knows his business. And he concluded, "I wish I knew my business as well as he does his." While Merton accepted the instinctual lives of animals as consistent with God's plan for them, he conceived of humans as being called to transcend the instinctual to a higher plane of consciousness, illuminated by an ethic of compassion that natural contemplation revealed. Through this encompassing compassion, which I think recalls Rousseau, who is mentioned by Merton in his thesis on Blake, all of creation would eventually be drawn towards unity. In the meantime, the animals were indicative, as in Hopkins' poetry, not only of the suffering of natural creatures, but, as in the case of the hawk, of its power and beauty. Partial, but all the same real signs, as Merton recognized was the case with Blake's tiger, of the power that created them. For Merton, all of God's creatures as creatures bore the stamp of God's reality and love, and in privileged moments he felt the very presence of God in nature. Sitting alone in the novitiate chapel at the Abbey in February of 1958, for example, he was held breathless by the incandescent beauty of a bowl of flowers. Beauty of sunlight falling on a tall vase of red and white carnations and green leaves on the altar of the novitiate chapel, the light and dark, the darkness of the fresh crinkled flower, light, warm, and red all around the darkness. The flower is the same color as blood, but it is in no sense whatever as red as blood. It is as red as a carnation, only that. This flower, this light, this moment, this silence. Dominus est. Eternity. He passes, he remains, we pass, in and out. He passes, we remain, we are nothing, we are everything. He is in us, he is gone from us. He is not here, we are in him. The scene captures the relaxed openness of what Merton called natural contemplation, a consciousness of the continuing presence of God in the world and in his world. At the same time, there is no sense of an active personal presence of God in Merton's soul, of the sort of infused contemplation that rarely appears in Merton's writings. Merton regarded active contemplation as the experiencing of God in one's daily life. For Merton, an example of the bridging of active contemplation and the action that could flow from this kind of contemplation was the social activism of Daniel and Philip Berrigan. The Berrigans' protests were directed against the Vietnam War in particular, a war that had been tacitly endorsed by no less a figure than New York's Cardinal Spellman. Before becoming involved in a particular protest action, the Berrigans would gather in prayer and meditation to weigh the value of the civil dissent they were on the verge of expressing. Like Merton, the Berrigans had been strongly influenced by Dorothy Day. I hope you know about Dorothy Day, very important American figure. And Day had emphasized the need not only to help the poor, but to stand up for them, if need be, against the political and even the ecclesiastical establishment. Thomas Merton and Daniel Berrigan were both writers and both internationalists, perceiving the world at large as their proper sphere of action and thus committed to breaking down the rather stifling nationalism of the American Catholic Church. In addition, both Merton and Berrigan were personalists in their approach to history, believing that history was made by extraordinary individuals such as Gandhi or Hitler, who acted, for better or for worse, against the grain of relatively stagnant institutions and traditions. Thus, for Merton to be part of society inevitably meant not only being part of a particular political and social system, but in a sense to walk around inside the heads of those whose vision created particular societies. Although this personalist view of history, in some unintended ways it might be said, overlaps with Nietzsche's social and political ideas about the ways in which societies take shape historically, Merton, of course, looked towards a society dominated by the personality of Christ. The difference between Christ and other shaping rulers of history is that, as Merton put it in his 1961 book, The New Man, through our entering into the life of Christ, we thereby come to participate in God's own vision of himself. For Merton, religious contemplation enabled such a participation in a history intersected by transcendental reality. In 1963, Merton committed himself to social activism to the extent that he gathered a select interdenominational group together at his monastery to consider the Christian response to the causes of war and to civil dissent. The participants included Daniel Berrigan, James Forrest of the group The Fellowship of Reconciliation, John Yoder, the Mennonite, and Tony Walsh, who was somewhat influenced by Dorothy Day, and he had founded a kind of Catholic worker house in Montreal. I don't know whether you ever heard of Tony Walsh or that. Oh, it's a very interesting chapter of Canadian religious history, in a way. In a letter to Daniel Berrigan, written in July of 63, Merton concluded that while the cause of social justice should not involve drawing the monk out of his monastery, it also didn't mean that the monk should be completely isolated from his society in the name of a, quote, literalist and antiquarian concept of the contemplative life, end quote. If Berrigan had encouraged Merton to take some measure of responsibility for the fate of the world, Merton in turn encouraged Berrigan to nourish the contemplative side of himself so as to balance and deepen his acts of social protest. In a letter to Berrigan written in March of 62, Merton emphasized the need for a solitary, bare, dark, beyond concept, beyond thought, beyond feeling type of prayer, characterizing this as the secret stabilizer and compass of the Christian life. Merton argued in a subsequent letter that the solitary, contemplative life was compatible with offering help to those who were herded into institutionalized groupings that, in his words, made them hate and misunderstand one another. In the 60s, Merton reacted to a felt challenge to make the monastic and the contemplative life relevant to the modern world. In this, he was influenced not only by Daniel Berrigan and Dorothy Day, but also by the social theorist Hannah Arendt, whose political analysis of 20th century history, particularly of totalitarianism, Merton found valuable. Following Marx to some extent, Arendt underlined the need for a balance between thought and action. Marx had argued that while philosophy found its material weapons in the proletariat, that is, in historical actuality, so the proletariat found its intellectual weapons in philosophy. In a paper delivered in Thailand in 68, Merton saluted Marx's attempt to draw those in capitalist societies away from self-interest to a more communitarian social model. Moving in a similar direction, Arendt concluded that the reason why Christianity, with its insistence on the sacredness of life, had never developed a positive labor philosophy lay in the unquestioned priority given to the contemplative life. Merton would have been very much in agreement with Arendt's criticizing of a contemplation that led to quietism. Increasingly in the 60s, Merton came to believe that religious contemplation existed not only for the good of the individual, but for the good of the community. Thinking about the development of the Cold War in the 60s, for example, he feared that the world might be approaching its destructive end due to the proliferation of nuclear weapons. With a somewhat removed perspective of the contemplative, however, he focused not on the makers of war, those who were the subject of the world's news, but on the victims, those who constituted the majority on both sides of any war. As for the architects of war, Merton argued in a trenchant essay on Adolf Eichmann in 1966 that in modern industrial states, the most cruel and catastrophic wars were being managed by cool-headed administrators with a talent for organizational planning. A perversion of reason that involved the substitution of instrumental reason for teleological reason or wisdom. Reflecting on the meaning of Eichmann's role in Nazi Germany, Merton saw him not as exceptional, but rather as typical of the approach in the West to modern technological warfare. In harmony with the views of Albert Camus, a writer about whom he became more and more engrossed in the 60s, Merton contended that political and military administrators had to learn to be less sane and more skeptical about the institutional ideologies that propelled them. Instead of thinking of religious contemplatives as atypical and narrow in their interests, as society might, Merton believed that the solitude of contemplatives gave them a perspectival breadth that enabled them to escape the loneliness and emptiness derived from the fear of death and the need for self-affirmation. The solitary contemplative detached from the pursuit of social status and the competition for wealth, thus became freed from the collective mirror. By choosing to live in physical poverty, the monk contemplative chose something that others would ordinarily dread, and was thus able to point to the risk of a greater, frequently overlooked, poverty of the spirit. As poet and essayist, Merton frequently addressed this matter, as in his 1965 essay, Rain and the Rhinoceros. In that essay, he considered the plight of Berenger, the central character in Ionesco's play, Rhinoceros. In that play, Berenger is a solitary human being trapped in a society of rhinoceroses. Without a contemplative dimension, Merton observes, Berenger lacks a fundamental sense of himself as real. The play depicts how social and institutional versions of reality tend to choke out the shy, tentative shoots sent forth by the self. Apart from this benefit to the self, the importance of religious contemplation for society as a whole, Merton felt, was that human beings would find themselves freed from the need to kill, and especially without the need to kill in good conscience. Merton's search for God in the world and in his own life, in trying to balance active contemplation and social justice, can be seen in his poem, The Originators, 1967. In that poem, he pictures the effect of his writings on some of his readers, those who, for the most part, live beyond the monastery walls. Because I chose to hear a special thunder in my head, or to see an occipital light, my choice suddenly became another's fate. He lost all his wheels, or found himself flying. With the phrase occipital light, Merton refers to the back of his skull, which contains no space for eyes, and therefore he appears to point to a light within. In the pre-dawn hours, he tells his readers, his mind was overcome with fever at about 4, a time when influence went out of his windows. The scene invites us to consider the paradox of the monk who, at his desk before morning light, while the rest of the world around him sleeps, nevertheless plays a significant role in the lives of those sleepers. The most paradoxical part of the poem has to do with the intensity of the poet-monk's influence. And when the other's nerve ends crowed and protested in the tame furies of a business gospel, his feeling was my explosion. So I skidded off his stone head, blind as a bullet, but found I was wearing his hat. The poem's power springs from the surprising violence of the imagery, especially the bullet. Even though the effect of this image is softened by the realization that the bullet has been fired from a circus gun. Overall, however, the lines depict a spiral in which the words of the monk contemplative provoke social change beyond the monastery, with this change in turn stirring the monk reciprocally to further contemplative reflection, and so on. Writing to Berrigan in February of 64 about a group of poets in Mexico, Merton observed that his contribution was to throw stones in the air, and if somebody yelled, he would know that a stone had come down. In spite of the balance that marked Merton's view of religious contemplation and action, a balance arrived at in the late 50s, after he'd been in the monastery for almost 20 years, he never lost the desire for infused contemplation, the crown jewel of the monastic life, as he thought of it. One has a sense of this desire in the autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, in which he recalled his first hushed visit to the Abbey of Gethsemane in 1941. And I'll skip that, I think, that long passage. He settled into his monastic routine in the 40s. Merton then came to feel somewhat frustrated by the business of the monk's life. He realized the enveloping communalism which prevented the sort of solitude to which he felt attracted. The conflict arose not only because of the writing which he was asked to do, but a conflict about writing itself that emerged from the deeply rooted part of himself. As a writer, he was centered on the creation of new forms, while as a contemplative, he attempted to enter his soul in order to meet with the God who had created and who sustained that soul. In such a meeting, his disposition would have to be passive in order to allow God to work upon him, something that Merton believed was unattainable within the active state of creative composition. The problem was that the writer would be inclined to cannibalize the fruits of contemplation by turning these into poems or journal entries, thereby short-circuiting the deeper journey towards God through infused contemplation. On the other hand, what if, Merton reflected, God wanted him to write? Fine, he concluded in the aforementioned essay, Poetry and the Contemplative Life, but one should not confuse the vocation of the artist and writer with a greater vocation to a life centered on infused contemplation. In his revised essay on the subject of poetry and contemplation, Merton distanced himself from his earlier argument that infused contemplation involved a kind of spiritual stillness, where one waited breathlessly for the presence of God. In actual fact, he added, contemplation was inseparable from life and from the dynamism of life. Indeed, he said, contemplation was the very fullness of a fully integrated life. Merton later illustrated what he meant by this sort of integration in a story he told on his trip to Alaska in 68 about an old Trappist monk, Father Stephen, who had a passion for gardening, which was thwarted by the demands of his abbot that he restrain this love of gardening in order to live a more balanced and more conventional monastic life. When a new abbot took over, the old monk was released from his duties in order to give his time to gardening. And in time, he died simply and happily in his garden. For Merton, Father Stephen was a person in whom the contemplation of God and the leading of life were one. He was one who was full of love, one of those who were, in Merton's words, fully unified and fully themselves, real people. While such an integration of the active and contemplative life appealed to Merton, he made it clear that one who had a vocation as a writer would essentially be wasting his time in long hours of contemplation, while the person called to the contemplative life would certainly be wasting his vocation in writing. Merton conceded that a few individuals, such as St. John of the Cross, appeared to have been able to sustain both vocations without significant overlapping. Therefore, in an effort to accommodate the different states of mind in which he found himself, in different parts of the day, Merton used different journals to register these different kinds of thinking and writing. But in retrospect, these journals appear to have been largely, this is my own view, I suppose, grist for the writer's mill. There are moments, especially in the early writings, as in the epilogue to The Seven Story Mountain, when one becomes aware of Merton's silent colloquy with God. In that particular encounter, he hears the voice of God calling him to a life of asceticism and solitude in which everything that can be desired, it is said, he says, will sear you. an important signal for Merton, who needed this divine correction to offset his chronic craving for recognition as a writer. So again, to repeat the voice of God, this is a rare moment in Merton. The voice he hears says, "Everything that can be desired will sear you, will burn you." It is not clear how much of Merton's life was spent in infused contemplation, since such experience would by its very nature have been ineffable. Looking for evidence of infused contemplation in his writings is somewhat analogous, perhaps, to looking for emotion, the emotion that was recollected in tranquility, as Wordsworth described the transformation of experience into poetry. In spite of this indirectness, however, there is one piece of writing that appears to have closely followed an experience of infused contemplation. And this is the Firewatch epilogue to the journal The Sign of Jonas. I don't know if you know that book. It's a very significant book, or a wonderful book by Merton, a diary. It came out in 1953. In that book, Merton recounts his experience one night on his rounds as the monastery's night watchman. His movements take him back to the most ancient part of the abbey, which was founded in 1848. And he records both his own early history in the monastery, as well as his knowledge of the abbey's extensive history. The narrative is so vividly constructed that the reader has something of a spontaneous experience of Merton's walk through his nocturnal rounds and of his increasing awareness that God was close to him. As he makes his way quietly through the corridors of Our Lady of Gethsemane, aware that his fellow monks are all sleeping, he eventually feels as he climbs towards the belfry, the heat of the day give way to the cooler night breezes. Exposed to the night air at last, he suddenly experiences the intimacy of God's presence. "And now my whole being breathes the wind which blows through the belfry. My hand is on the door through which I see the heavens. The door swings out upon a vast sea of darkness and prayer. Will it come like this, the moment of my death? Will you open a door upon the great forest and set my feet upon a ladder under the moon and take me out among the stars?" Much of the silent talk with God involves Merton's anxieties about his vocation and his desire to ensure that he is where God wants him to be. Slowly, though, he moves from questions about his own life and destiny to an urgent desire to hear God without the deafening static of his own importunateness. Realizing the barrier that his own concerns present in this attempt to listen to God, and stymied by the empty silence that follows, Merton fortuitously remembers that God had historically spoken to other human beings, and in particular to Jonas. The image of Jonas surfaces naturally because Merton has thought of his years at the monastery as analogous to Jonas's immersion in the body of the whale. In any case, he intuitively adopts a strategy whereby he discards the preoccupations of his own ego, however momentarily, in order to hide under Jonas's cloak, as it were. And at that moment, the voice of God is heard. "I have always overshadowed Jonas with my mercy, and cruelty I know not at all. Have you had sight of me, Jonas, my child?" Beneath the heard assurance that all is mercy, all is forgiven, Merton feels the shell of his ego dissolve, and instead of a nagging preoccupation about who he is and what God wants him to be, he instead becomes aware of the divine voice speaking in a manner that resolves all questions, settles all anxieties. "I have forgiven the universe without end because I have never known sin." Anxious for God to tell him about his own destiny, Merton is confronted with a God who is anxious, as it were, to reveal the reality of himself. Through this reversal, Merton learns to see his own self more clearly by seeing it in relation to God and to God's perception of himself as a creature surrounded by God's boundless mercy. The Firewatch was written when Merton was a relatively young man. There were later moments in his experience, particularly in his journals, which point to his encounter with the transcendental, especially on his trip to the Himalayas in 1968. There seems little doubt that Merton experienced an epiphany in looking at the great stone Buddhas in Sri Lanka. I don't know when in my life, he wrote in his journal, I have had such a sense of beauty and spiritual validity running together in one aesthetic illumination. The rock, all matter, all life, he added, were charged with Dharmakaya. He was especially moved by the power of the figures to express an understanding that saw through all apparent contradictions and that transcended the oppositional hurdles of argument that in Merton's view plagued Western perspectives and discourse. The Buddhist framing of the experience allowed Merton to visualize the Christian mystical tradition to which he belonged in a new way, without his feeling that he had to give up his core beliefs. Nevertheless, there was a noticeable change in his writings in the 60s to a more philosophical reading of his experience, away from the scenario of a dramatic personal encounter with a providential God that had been reflected in the Firewatch epilogue to The Sign of Jonas in the early 50s. In retrospect, one comes to think of Merton as a banyan tree. I don't know, do you know that tree? You see them in Australia or in New Zealand and so on, in Asia. But the image comes to mind for me. I think of Merton as a banyan tree. This is a tree whose branches profusely grow shoots that in turn take root. So you have the new growth, a very unusual growth in that way. And so it was Merton's way in the 60s to add to his accumulated perceptions about God by relating these perceptions to fresh contexts. Without being merely pluralistic, he searched culture, including religious, philosophical, and literary culture, for more inclusive ways of dealing with his own spiritual experience. Extending his field of inquiry, he became interested, for example, in the philosophy of Camus and Heidegger. Heidegger's phenomenology posited a direct intuitive apprehension of being that preceded systematic reasoning that involved an awareness of the world through one's direct consciousness of personal existence. Furthermore, Heidegger concluded, Merton felt, such consciousness of being obviated the usual epistemological subject-object division. All of this was consistent with Merton's interest in existentialism in the 1960s. In his journal Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, he attempted to relate his own ancient monastic way of life to the modern period by bridging the thought of the 11th century scholastic philosopher and theologian Saint Anselm with the existentialism of Jean-Paul Sartre. What is interesting about this attempt to bridge these two very different cultural worlds is Merton's presentation of Anselm as an early existentialist. Anselm does not start from a notion of God. He starts from the direct awareness of God as the ground of being that cannot not be. To love God for his own sake is therefore not just to love the notion of an omnipotent and all-good Father. It is, on the contrary, to love him who is, without knowing really who or what he is. That is to love God without knowing really who or what he is. Simply because he is, and because his being is existentially present to us as the ground of all existence, all knowledge, all freedom, and all love. Although Merton pays homage to the traditional essentialist notion of God as ultimate truth and goodness, his interest here is clearly not in essentialism. Rather, he is drawn, as Blake had been, to a dynamic God, a God who is the epitome of creativity and freedom, an existentialist God. For Merton, the divine existentialism had been illuminated by Christ, who manifested the kind of existence God has, a sacrificial, generous, and loving sharing of being that contrasts with the bleak existentialism set forth by Sartre. For those who approach being from other than Christian eyes, Merton saw a similar divine compassion radiating from the center of existence, as in his startling view in 1968 of the great stone Buddhas in Sri Lanka, whose expression, he wrote, conveyed, quote, an inexhaustible emptiness and compassion. Merton's focus on being can be seen in his writings about Buddhism in the 60s. What appealed him about Buddhism, phenomenology, and existentialism was that these intuitive modes of thought resolve the tension between contemplation and action by allowing one to see being as an intermediate and unifying space in which thought and action, subject and object, were ontologically unified. Coincidental with Merton's focus on being in the late 60s, he found himself wanting to pull away from his polemical writings about racism and war, about which he felt he had said enough. His withdrawal from such writing was provoked in part by the actions of the Berrigans, who in a highly publicized draft card burning in Maryland seemed to Merton to have crossed the line of violence. At the same time, in a book entitled Contemplation in a World of Action, published in 69, he urged his fellow monks to be open to the world and aware of its problems, suggesting that monasteries themselves might become a haven of solitude and sanity for those seeking an alternative to the pressures and alienation of mainstream society. In 1968, the year in which he died, Merton visited a number of possible sites for a new hermitage in an effort to find a solitude that he feared was no longer possible at his frequently visited hermitage at the Abbey of Gethsemane. It seems clear that at this time he wanted to sink deeper into his contemplative vocation. Characteristically, however, the writer in him was busy planning a dictionary of mystical terminology comparing the language and concepts of the world's major contemplative traditions. That he did not live to complete this work is a great pity. What he did do, as few have done, was to awaken readers in his own and in our time to the richness and depth of religious contemplation. And for this, we need feel no sense of loss. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ross. Beautifully spoken, with cogency, elegance, insight. I think we all come to know Thomas Merton better. Would you be able to respond to a question or two?
Try.
Please. Let's continue.
One quick one. What
yes.
The name again of the
Ionesco
play?
It's called Rhinoceros. It's a wonderful play. One used to not be able to go to the theater without seeing it. but it's dropped below the horizon somehow in recent years. It's a very good play. So it's an absurdist play in that tradition. Okay. Yes.
I wonder if you could say something about Merton's practice of contemplation. From a couple of examples you gave us, it seemed as if, in a sense, he engaged something which created a contemplative impulse, such as the Buddhas or the Himalayas. Mm-hmm. But was there a more disciplined form of contemplation that
you
perceived as well, and if so, what shape did it take?
Well, there were the arrows devoted to prayer within the monastic cycle, which would have provided him with opportunities of that sort, but the odd thing, I think, is that these moments that I spoke of, that he's recorded for us, do indeed seem moments that in some ways were as agreeable to the writer as to the contemplative. So I think the shadow of the writer is with him almost always. If we do seek the emotion that was later recollected in tranquility, we only see it as it has been recollected in tranquility. And that's to be expected, I suppose. But it seems to me that the writer was always there. So that was his, if you like, his problem. It was a theoretical problem that he had at first, but I think eventually he simply said to himself, well, this appears to be what God wants for me, this kind of odd life of straddling these two things, and so longing always for something more intense, I suppose, and so on. It's only rarely that you see it in his writing. Of course, he's recommending it constantly for others. You know, he's sort of talking about infused contemplation, but it's as if he's standing up here telling you about infused contemplation, spending most of his time, or much of his time, doing that. But he certainly knows the thing that he's after. He knows what to call it. He knows what it's like. He's experienced it, it seems. But only with the cooperation of the writer, I think, has that occurred. Okay, yes, Dennis.
My question may just reveal my own ignorance, but I'm curious. You said that Merton wasn't merely pluralistic.
Yes.
He was clearly drawn to
Buddhism.
Buddhism, particularly. And I'm just in my ignorant way sitting here wondering, what is it specifically about Merton that is Christian, if anything? You mentioned the character of Christ in one sentence. That was about the only place it appeared in your talk. You can do everything other than. So there's your question.
Well, his belief structure, his doctrinal belief structure, if we could put it that way, in my opinion, stayed more or less intact throughout his career. So this is why I tried to use the image of the banyan tree. That's there. And he moves out. He moves out without leaving. He stays and moves out at the same time. This is why it's so interesting, I think, that he as he moves out, he looks for both something new, which would illuminate his own experience as a human being, as well as a Christian. And at the same time, he looks for resemblance. He looks to see if there are resemblances. And that's why I think he had in mind this very interesting project of doing a kind of dictionary of mystical terminology, because he felt that there were going to be differences, but there would also be similarities, and he wanted to sort of see what these were just at the very end. And he was finally getting into a position where he could do that. He finally knew enough. So, okay. Okay, well, it's been a long and a warm afternoon. Is there any other matters? Yes, Olaf.
Also displays ignorance, and I apologize for that. But the notion of a balanced Christian life and the search for quietness and detachment from the day-to-day hustle and bustle. We are so immersed in hustle and bustle, the idea that running away from it is a denial of that balance.
Well, I think he felt that, we see more of this situation you describe every day. I mean, we're now chained to our computers in a way we could not have foreseen 20 years ago or so. And I think for Merton, this was going to be inevitable, that in a highly technological culture like our own, with its fascinating things, that we would be that way. So what he claims is that if we live in this kind of culture and are guided by its criteria, its norms, we lose not only God, but we lose ourselves. And so he would argue that you can go through the world without being immersed totally. In other words, you don't even have to go to the monastery or cut yourself off for a retreat in a lakeside cabin or something of that sort. But as I read Merton and see him going about his own world, it's clear that in some ways he goes through the world without a sense of its having captured him. I remember once reading a comment by Daniel Berrigan that reminded me of Merton's view on this. Berrigan said, and Berrigan loves a lot of the things of this world, especially food. He's a cook. He makes wonderful, interesting meals. But Berrigan said that these are fine, these are things we enjoy and so on, but in some ways the Christian looks through them, doesn't reject them, but looks through them as if they were transparent. And to some extent I think that was true of Merton as well. He was able to do that. He loved life, and he had many interesting friends. As you heard, people who would visit him more than he wanted. Eventually, he was thinking of moving because he himself was having difficulty with the very issue you're describing. People were landing on his doorstep, or writing to him and getting in touch with him and so on. So for Merton, there's a kind of detachment one can have. I was going to illustrate this with a little story from my own experience, because I think it's consistent with Merton's view, so if you would bear with me. Some years ago, I had to give a lecture with a group of people who were colleagues, and a large, fairly large group of people in a lecture theater. I'd not done this sort of thing before, and I was nervous, if not anxious, about this. And as I came to the lectern, I thought to myself, love them. Just love them. Love these people and their whatever their lives are. And so for that split second, I felt released from the kind of immersion in the society that you speak of. I think that was Merton's suggestion to us, that we can do that. And in fact, in a more physical sense, he said, the monasteries themselves might do more of this to at least initiate people into, for once, just getting out. And then, of course, their lives might change in some way as a result of that. And they might need that kind of monastic haven more rarely once they settle their own movement and stability, spiritual stability within that kind of society. I don't know if that helps. Okay, anything else? Good. Great. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Ross. That's wonderful. We can perhaps continue our discussion. There's coffee here, too. Have a look at Ross's works, and I think we may have heard something that we'll look forward to, a new book on Thomas Merton.
Perhaps an article.
The work continues.
Yeah,
very pleased for that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.